Well, today we have Fabien Louvet. As usual, a few words about his CV. Fabien graduated at Paris Sud, working at CEO Saclay 6 years ago, right? And then he moved to Chile for 3 years. Finally funded by the program Fondesit, so with a fellowship at the Universidad de Chile in Santiago. More recently, Fabien moved back to France with a Marie Curie fellowship, working at COA with Hennebel and the Ecole Normale Supérieure with Gersdorf and Zafre. On the topics that he will explain during this talk. So, Fabien, if you agree, we used to record the seminar, so everybody can download it in the video from the Gecko week for the Cafe Club webpage. You have 30 minutes, 20-25 for the talk, and the people is invited to ask questions also in meanwhile.
Okay, no problem. Ask your question whenever you want. And if I don't finish the presentation, it's fine. There is no problem. So don't hesitate to interrupt me. So thank you very much, Carlo, and thank you as well to Annie for this opportunity of presenting a bit my work, but more broadly, staff formation. So just before that, I want to make a small announcement that next week I'm organizing a conference. It's called the Maetic Field Awaken Conference. It's about the connection between star formation and magnetic field. So now it's gathering about 200 people around the world. And today is the last day for registration. So if you want to enjoy this meeting, please register today. So I will be talking about star formation, trying to make the link between low mass star formation and high mass star formation. So I could go through scenarios, empirical scenarios of star formation for low mass and high mass, but instead of explaining each scale, I propose to go through scales. So I will try at each scale to make the comparison between low mass and high mass. So we'll be talking about the morphology that that we have in high mass and in low mass, about the cloud content, so the type of stars and the type of cores that we form to these molecular clouds. And then I will not talk about the core evolution and about the problem of not finding a high mass pre-stellar core. And I will jump directly to the disk and accretion. So first thing first, the morphologies of molecular clouds. So here I put two images of molecular clouds, one of low mass on the left-hand side and one of high mass on the right-hand side. So here it's Aquila and here it's DR21. What you can see by high is that in the case of low mass, what we witness is a network of filaments that have been extensively investigated by Doris, who is attending the meeting. So we have this network of filaments in the case of low mass star formation, whereas in the case of high mass star formation, what we see is rather one structure that completely dominates its environment. So that's the bulk of the mass. We call it either a ridge when it's slightly elongated or a hub when it's completely centered. And what you see here that look like filaments are not really filaments, but they are accretion streams. If you look into the velocity, you see velocity gradients along this accretion stream. So these streams are feeding in gas at the central part. So one idea to explain these differences was to say that maybe the low mass star forming region is a quiescent evolution of a molecular cloud, whereas the case of high mass star formation is perhaps first due to a collision between two clouds that permits to gather a lot of mass in a single point in a time that is reasonable compared to star formation. So in the case of this cloud-cloud collision, we would have, as is advocated by this sketch, two clouds that collide at small velocities. And that would generate what we call low velocity shocks. Actually, these shocks have been proposed, in the case of high mass star formation, into many regions, because we do see some large-scale SIO mission, which is a shock tracer, in many regions. And here I put the example of W43, where we do see this very extended SIO mission of about 6 parsec long, I believe. And the problem of all these observations is that they are not able to differentiate between SIO that would be due to protostellar activity, so due to outflows, or to really low velocity shocks homogeneous. So what we did a few years ago is to observe this region, W43, with an interferometer, with NOEMA. And we showed that we do have a protocluster, so we have some outflows that are forming, but none of this outflow is able to explain for this large-scale SIO emission. And actually, if we look more in detail into a spectroscopy, we witness that the SIO emission is very homogeneous and has a narrow peak, of only about 6 kilometers per second. So this is completely in favor. Actually, it's proving that we have some low velocity shocks in W43. So actually, this paradigm of quiescent versus closed collision has also been investigated in numerical simulations. Just after our publication, there was this paper by Benjamin Wu, who studied this paradigm of quiescent versus closed collision in numerical simulation. So in the one case, he let one cloud evolve, so you have some turbulence on some magnetic field, whereas in the other case, he starts his simulation with the collision of two clouds. And in the case of quiescent evolution, he showed that we do have a network of filaments that are forming, and protostars that are mimicked by sync particles here, forming onto the crest of the filament, exactly like in the case of low mass star formation. Whereas when you have this cloud-cloud collision, you are gathering the majority of the mass into a central part, so it's gathering the bulk of the mass, and the protostar, from the star activity, is forming not necessarily associated with these accretion streams, but more all over the place into the central park place. So one important feature, interesting feature also, is the connection of this, the formation of filaments, of the content of filaments with the magnetic field. So, here is the example of Aquila, here it's Taurus, so it's not the same region, it's just for illustration. So that was an observation by Pedro that also spent some time in LAM. Here you have, I think, B211 filaments. So you see the filaments that are highlighted by this black line and the polarization that is shown with semi-vector in green. And the striations that are low-density material, filamentary-like, but not gravitationally bound, that are highlighted by this blue line. And what Pedro showed is that the blue line, so the striation, appears to be parallel with respect to the magnetic field, whereas the black line, so the self-gravitating filaments, appears to be perpendicular to the emission of, to the magnetic field. Actually, there was some theoretical explanation for that before the publication, is that in the case of a striation, if you assume that you have isotropic gas that is expanding in every direction, they will fail the magnetic pressure. So they will be stopped by the magnetic field and will accumulate along the magnetic field lines, which explain why the striations are parallel to the magnetic field. Whereas in the case of a self-gravitating structure that wants or tends to collapse, it's much easier to collapse along the magnetic field lines than across the magnetic field line, where you will feel this magnetic pressure. So this explains why the self-gravitating structure appear to be perpendicular with respect to the magnetic field. In the case of high mass star formation, the picture is not that clear. Here is one example, a map I did with the ALMA interferometer toward one high mass star forming region. So here, if you assume that this gray shade image is a filamentary structure, elongated filamentary structure, Here you have the orientation of magnetic field. You see that it's sometimes it's parallel, perpendicular, and parallel again. So there is no direct link between the elongation of filaments and the magnetic field. But there might be some interaction with the formation of cores themselves. So what I wanted to do is to test one model. It is a model for strongly magnetized core that advocates that in the case of a strong magnetic field, the core will collapse perpendicular parallel to magnetic field, as for the case of filaments. So you expect to see the elongation of cores to be perpendicular to magnetic field. So to test this view with my student, we compared the orientation of the magnetic field with respect to the orientation of the cores. So we have actually three times this sample, we have three times this map, and what we did is to compare this orientation. So it's represented into this plot, it's called a cumulative distribution diagram, but it's not very easy to read. So just to guide you, here you have 0% of a sample, and here you have 100% of a sample. And what we do, it's every 5 degrees, we count how many cores are encompassed between this type of beta, this type of orientation between beta here, rotation between core and magnetic field. And we accumulate this number of cores until reaching 100%. So the observation gives us this curve, the black curve here, and all the other curves are synthetic observation. So here it's 100,000 cores that are put in 3D space and oriented between 0 and 20 degrees with respect to the magnetic field. And what you can see in this plot is two things. It's first that the observation show that it's not random. We don't have a random rotation between the cores and the magnetic field. And the magnetized core scenario, so perpendicular, is this curve, is completely opposite with what we observe in this molecular plot. So we have an orientation, actually, which is between 20 and 50 degrees, but we cannot explain at the moment, and we are drawing some numerical simulation to try and understand this correspondence. So to conclude on to the closed morphology and in general molecular clouds, that we do have different morphology. We do have a network of filaments in the case of low mass star forming region, whereas we have one structure that completely dominates environment in the case of high mass star forming region. Seems that high mass star forming region is more associated to this cloud-cloud collision, but we do not observe at all in the case of low mass star formation. As for magnetic field, it seems to be associated with the formation of filaments in the case of low mass, where it seems to be more associated with the formation of cores in the case of high mass. So now I will try and see what kind of objects we are forming into this region in terms of stars and in terms of cores. For that, I need to introduce or reintroduce the initial mass function that most of you must know, but just if you are some students. The initial mass function is basically the counting of stars. If you take a globular cluster like this one, you measure the mass of each single star, and then you represent the number of stars that are present into a mass bin, and you obtain this curve, which is called the initial mass function of stars. It has been first observed by Salpeter in 1955, and since then, it has been observed to be basically universal in every cluster that we have observed. So people to understand the origin of this initial mass function has observed the region that are now forming stars. And instead of doing the counting of cores, they did of stars, they did the counting of cores. And they witnessed that the core mass function here in blue is very similar in shape with the initial mass function, with the same slope, so the high mass end that has a slope of -1.35, that really looks like the initial mass function. And if you assume a one-to-one correspondence between a core and a star of 30%, with an efficiency of 30%, you can directly shift the core mass function to the initial mass function, and you have explained for the origin of initial mass function. And to test the universality of the core mass function, what we did is to do the same work in high mass star forming region. So this is possible only for since a few years, thanks to Almine in particular, that permits to obtain a very good angular resolution, so physical resolution on regions that are very far away. And here is the case of W43, where we could extract a bit more than 100 cores, and we derived the core mass function in this region. And what we saw is that the core mass function is much, much flatter, or the high mass tail is much flatter than the initial mass function. So it's much flatter than the core mass function that have been found in low mass star forming region. So that was the first observation of a core mass function that does not mimic the initial mass function, which motivated us to propose a large program with ALMA that is now terminated, and we have all the data and we are analyzing the data. But it gives us already one lesson, is that it's very dangerous to extrapolate our knowledge that we gain in a low mass environment, or in local environment, in the Gould Belt, to the entire galaxy or to regions that are probably more typical of a star formation at a galactic scale. So, but also, besides the large program and besides what we did in W43, there are nowadays many evidence for having this flat core mass function in high mass star formation. Here I give four examples of very recent studies that showed that the slope of the core mass function is much flatter than the slope of the IMF. So we have slopes between -1 and -0.9 that are in contrast with the slope of the IMF on -1.35. Actually, there are some evidence also of top heavy or flatter initial mass function, so directly measuring the cluster of stars. Here it's the case in the LMC, where they showed that there is one cluster there that seems to have an initial mass function that is flatter than the IMF. And also, this work it was done in extra galaxy at high redshift, that showed that the integrated initial mass function is flatter than the IMF. So, to conclude, it seems that the slope of the core mass function resembles the slope of the initial mass function in low mass star forming region, but not in the case of high mass star forming region. So that brings the question to know if the initial mass function is or not universal. And this is very important for the understanding of star formation, for understanding of our galaxy, and for understanding of galaxy evolution, because it's stars that completely dominate the budget of energy in galaxies. So if the initial mass function is not universal, then we have to change our model of galaxy evolution. So here I want to take a step back and to try and understand what our cores really. Here is my latest work that is actually not yet published. I will submit it tomorrow. I did an exercise which is to see the effect of angular resolution onto what we call cores. So here is the region, it's the Aquila region, observed with three different angular resolution. And what you see by eye already is that the core, the size of the core completely depends on the angular resolution. But not only the size, but also what I show is that the core mass function also depends on the angular resolution. And actually, it's not only in Aquila, I did it also in one high mass star forming region in GC 6344, and also in 40 numerical simulations with varying the angular resolution to go at a better physical scale than what we have in Aquila. And in each case, I could see that what we define as a core completely depends on the angular resolution, and that the core mass function shifts happily with the angular resolution. So that shows that what we want, the object that we want, that are these cores that will form a star, must be of lower mass, because we have not yet been able to resolve these cores. And more importantly, we cannot directly compare the core mass function to the initial mass function. So what we are doing here is inaccurate. We don't have this efficiency of 30%. The efficiency would depend completely on the angular resolution at which you observe your region. So it brings back the question of knowing what is actually the real reservoir of gas to form a star. And this is a paramount question in case of a star formation and complicated one. Even in simulation, it's not quite clear to know where is the reservoir of mass that will form a thin particle or a star. So now I will not talk about the core evolution. I will skip directly to this kind of flow. I don't know how much time we have left, actually.
5 minutes, large, more than 5 minutes. 5 minutes.
Okay. So we'll just talk a bit about, I think I can finish that. I will talk about disk accretion and outflows. And again, I want to take a step back and take you at the beginning of my thesis. It was in 2011, when I started to work onto the paralleling of high-mass star formation. And I was told that the major problem of high-mass star formation was the radiation pressure catastrophe. Is that if you assume isotropic accretion onto a protostar, then your protostar gains in mass and the radiation pressure augments, rises. And there is one threshold at 8 solar masses where the radiation pressure is so strong that it can completely expulse the envelope. And you're left alone with a 8 solar masses star. The problem is that we do observe stars at much higher mass than 8 solar masses. It's the case, for example, in the Tarantella Nebula, which is the LMC, where I put the most massive known binary system with one star that would be about 300 solar masses and the other one 200 solar masses. So we do form stars way, way above this threshold of 8 solar masses. And actually, the answer to this problematic came in a way from the low mass formation community and the observation they had done, especially towards the circumstellar disk, the accretion disk around protostellar objects. So here I put an image of ALMA, but of course they were known before due to excess in infrared and observed for the first time by Hubble in the 90s, I believe. But it's thanks to this observation and to the talking between communities that Rolf Kuiper tried to put an anisotropic accretion onto a protostar through a disk, and he could show that if you put a disk, then you're able to form a massive star way above this threshold of 8 solar masses and reaching mass of about 150 solar masses nowadays. And actually, these disks around massive stars have been observed recently by Johnston. There is, I think, believe two examples at the moment of accretion disk or even Keplerian disk around massive protostars. Now, then the problem that comes from both low mass and high mass community is to understand the accretion in the disk. Because if you have a Keplerian disk, you do not have any accretion. A particle needs to lose a bit of angular momentum so it can migrate towards the protostar and be accreted by the latter. And for a long time, for about 30 years, we thought that this removal of angular momentum was due by the intermediate of an instability, the magneto-rotational instability, that has a term of interchange that permits to actually inject turbulence into the disk, and then by decay of the turbulence, you lose angular momentum. But in the most recent simulation, when you include non-ideal MHD, so the ambipolar diffusion, the mid diffusion, and the Hall effect, this instability basically dies. It's not working if you have non-ideal MHD. So for a few years, for a year or so, we did not have any explanation of how to accrete into a disk. But there is also another way to eject angular momentum, to extract angular momentum from the disk, is through the outflows. And outflows, we do observe them in both low mass star forming regime and high mass star forming regime. And in particular, there is one family, the magneto-hydrodynamic disk wind, that permit to extract a fraction of angular momentum. There are other families, of course, that explain for these outflows. You have a photo disk winds, you have X wind, and you have stellar winds, but these three letters do not eject angular momentum. There is only the MHD disk wind that permit to extract some angular momentum from the disk. And to try to discriminate which model were at play in the protostar, what we did is to observe the dynamic into the outflow. So here it's the case of it's a HH30 protostar. Here you have the disk and you see that it's rotating. It's redshifted and reshifted, so it's rotating in this direction. And what we wanted to know is if the outflow itself were rotating. So by doing some PV diagram, so it's a cut into the spectroscopic emission, so it's represented here, the tilt of this ellipse, so the difference between the peak here and the peak here, is showing that the outflow is rotating. But not only it rotates, but it also conserves the angular momentum along its propagation. And this is in very good agreement with the MHD disk wind, and actually not compatible with the photo disk wind. So we do have a proof, actually an evidence for the process of magnetic disk wind in the case of star formation, in the case of accretion towards the protostar, that could be at play in both low mass and high mass star formation. So I reach my conclusion. Basically saying that we do have some differences. We do have some different morphologies. We have a network of filaments in the case of low mass, whereas we have one dimensional structure in the case of high mass. It seems that we have more clotal collision in the case of high mass, which is all not at play in the case of low mass. It seems that the magnetic field is more associated with the formation of filaments in the case of low mass, whereas more associated with the case of cores in the case of high mass. But then when we go at smaller scales, really onto the accretion, onto the protostar, it seems to be similar processes with disks and with removal of angular momentum through the outflow process. But thank you for your attention. I will take any question. If you don't have questions, I am used to have these ones. People ask them when this one very frequently. So.
Thank you, Fabien, so much for your very nice talk. I have a question, but is there any question in the chat or raise your hand? Yeah, Samuel, please.
Yes, hello. Thank you for your nice presentation. I may have missed a few minutes somewhere in the middle, so maybe my question is already answered, but I apologize in advance if that's the case. But could you remind us where you put the limits, basically, for low mass and high mass star formation on one end, and on the other end, what is for a galaxy like the Milky Way, what is the balance? How much stars are formed in one regime or the other, and what decide finally? Do we have an idea of what brings us to one regime or the other?
To answer your first question, it's funny because it's complicated in a way, because you have a low mass, intermediate mass, and high mass. So we do put the threshold of difference at 8 solar masses for really the star 8 solar masses. So it's the ability to terminate into a supernova. So this is the high mass regime. Then you have the intermediate regime that goes between, let's say, 3 and 7 solar masses, and below 3 solar masses, you have a low mass regime. As for the second question, in terms of stellar mass, or in terms of number of objects, you do form much more low mass stars than high mass stars. If you look at the initial mass function, basically here, so this is 10. So this would be the high mass regime, and this would be the low mass regime. So in terms of number of objects, you do form much more low mass stars than high mass stars. But in terms of mass, of stellar mass, then it's not that different, the stellar mass formation of low mass and high mass, because when you form 100 solar mass, you need 300 objects of low mass, or even more, to compete with formation of one mass star. And the importance of high mass star is more the energetic. It's not the formation itself, the stellar winds that they have, and the the death itself, which was supernova that injects a lot of turbulence into the galaxy. So actually, if you're interested into galaxy evolution, you're much more interested into the life cycle of high mass stars than low mass stars. And that's for the explanation of the two type of regime. At the beginning, I was talking about probably the quiescent evolution of molecular clouds versus the more dynamic cloud-cloud collision that permits to have a lot of matter at a high density in a time that is smaller than the typical fragmentation time and star formation time.
Fabien, you have questions on the chat from Doris Hazomanian, who has an unstable connection. He acknowledges you for the very nice presentation. Maybe you can directly read the question on the chat. You mentioned that the cloud-cloud collision scenario is proper to the high mass case, not the low mass case. Can you repeat again on which basis you arrived to this conclusion? And then it says, I was part of a recent work done by Sylvain Bonton and Lars Bonn showing that the Mosca cloud and the Camaleon low-mass clouds are located at the intersection of larger scale colliding H1 clouds. Can you comment on this?
Yes. Oh, I forgot the first question. I'm sorry.
You can read it on the chat. It's more easy.
I can't. I can, but I.
You can. Okay. You mentioned that the cloud collision scenario is proper.
Okay. I can see. But yeah, I had to exit the presentation mode.
Yeah.
Yes. About the cloud collision, I have two evidences that we do not observe large scale SIO emission or shock tracer towards low mass. But when I mean large scale, it's more than parsec scales, about 10 parsec scales emission in a shock tracer. We do not have that into low mass regime. It's only observed towards the high mass regime and seems to be, let's say, it's ubiquitous, this observation of large scale emission. But the problem is that nowadays, due to lack of angular resolution in most of the studies, we don't know where this SIO comes from, if it comes from protostellar cluster or from really low velocity shocks. So what permits me to say that we do have cloud-cloud collision in the case of high mass is the observation we did with interferometry to really differentiate between proto-cluster emission and what is really a low velocity shock at large scale. And then as for the work of Sylvain with Lars, what they see is not what I call cloud-cloud collision. What I call cloud-cloud collision is more than it's already dense material that is colliding at large scale and encompass already a lot of mass. It's a 10 to the 5 solar mass clouds that are colliding together. In the case of Lars, what he shows is more low density material, what I would call like a filament collision, that is more into the scenario of star formation by Enrique Vasquez Cimadini, which is the global collapse scenario, in which you do have some small scales filament collision. So I differentiate the two. It's really a cloud, molecular cloud collision, and internal filamentary collision.
Sorry, I was muted. I hope your answer is fine for Doris. I don't see any other comment or raised hand. I have a very nice question. Do you can you probe an observation, or eventually do you see in the simulations about the first part of your talk, coherent motion of ionized gas along filaments, eventually justifying the possible pattern of the magnetic field perpendicular to the central part of the filaments, far from the core.
So you're asking me if I would see.
Very naively, I think about a flow of electric charges along a filament, producing a magnetic field perpendicular to the filament.
So
it seems that the green lines are perpendicular to the filament, roughly.
At the moment, the simulations that I'm running do not include, let's say, globally, they do not include radiative transfer. So I have just, I'm just taking into account the cooling, but not really radiative transfer. So I cannot tell you which part of the gas is ionized or not.
Okay, and but eventually, can you guess for some fraction of the gas, of the total gas you have in your hydrodynamical simulation, I suppose, as ionized, and then infer the flow, so the motion, the velocity of these gas along filaments?
So this we can do, kinematics, we can definitely do it. So it's what, to be honest, it's what I'm doing now in the case of high mass regime. I'm doing it in this framework to see if I have some correlation between the magnetic field and the gas dynamics into simulation and into observations, to see if there is really a play of magnetic field for guiding the gas. But as I told you, I'm not dealing with ionization fraction, so I'm basically into ideal MHD, where I take an ad hoc fractionization fraction of a gas to have interplay between gas and the magnetic field.
Thank you.
So I'm not yet at this point.
Thank you.
It was not a naive question.
Thank you. Any other comment or question? Nothing. So I think we can thank you again for your very nice talk. So see you next week. We have all the next Wednesday until Christmas already scheduled. So take care. I'll see you next week. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.